Hello, everyone. I'm Nate Truex, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host, Nate. And after a couple of years, I'm joined once again by Dr. Zach Loffman of West Liberty University. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me again, man. Happy to be here.
Yeah. For people who've been a long-time listener of the show, you might remember Zach from, probably like the 10th or 11th episode of Procast, all the way back in, I think it was like 2022, maybe. Maybe 2021. I think it was about the same time CCR started, if I'm right.
Yeah, it was definitely around that time.
So, how you been? Anything, any major catch-ups and news we should know about ever since you last came on?
Oh, my God. There's been more than a little that's happened since 2021 or 22. I'm sure we'll cover things like Colubrid Fest and the podcast and the Conservation Corps. But I guess the biggest thing worthy of discussion would be academically and professionally, I was kind of having a herpetology lab at arm's length. And I fought it for a very long time, and then the opportunity arose to study wild plains hognose snakes in Iowa and literally do the project I dreamed about doing when I was an undergrad. And I was like, okay, this is ridiculous. We can do two research labs. So I now have the applied herpetology and herpetoculture lab at West Liberty University that I serve as the advisor for. And I have multiple graduate students and undergrads and field-based projects and herpetoculture-based projects, and it's pretty awesome. So that's the biggie, I would say. Yeah. Oh, and I published a book, so I did that too.
Yeah, small deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen thicker books, but
yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this hognose book that I'm working on right now, and I spent all last week. Pretty much this week. The only day I took off was Christmas. It's going to be enormous. I'm actually like freaking out because I don't know how the hell we can fit it all into one book. Because they also, it's going to be the complete guide to hognose snakes. So I'm doing the whole genus. I'm not just doing Western hogs, but Bob Ashley, Eco Publishing, they want the morphs in there. And
oh gosh,
mother of God, that alone will add like 300 to 400 pages. And I don't know the morphs, that's not my jam. So I had to bring on John Rice with Fathom Hogs to cover that. And we are actually meeting next week to figure out how in the hell we can put all my stuff, all his stuff together into one book. It's probably gonna rival, I'm looking at it right now. Kevin McClurley did the Complete Guide to Ball Pythons. The first one's like an inch thick. And then they did what they called the Ultimate Ball Python. And that thing is like an inch and a half, inch and three quarters thick. And this hog book right now is set to be that big. So I don't know.
I'm looking over at my bookshelf and I have the more complete carpet python, you know, the mm-hmm. good old Zoolander. Zoolander just rolls off tongue with the snake guy, right?
It does.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, and yeah, that thing is about as thick as my Bible, so.
Yeah, no, it's going to be that big, because with all the photographs and there's a lot. Well, it's kind of weird. There's been a lot written about hognose snakes, but at the same time, not that much. And I'm trying to be as thorough as I can with the ecology, biology, natural history. And so, you know, I've done annotated bibs on over 200 journal articles, book chapters, species accounts, and regional field guides. And, there's just a lot.
Yeah. So, I was going to say, have you thought of a title for a hognose snake book that's as thick as the Bible?
I'm just going to go with the complete guide to, hognose snakes. I think that's all we're doing.
I was gonna say,
I am pushing for a two volume set, but I don't know if I'm gonna win that battle.
Yeah,
so
I was going to say it'd be kind of fun if you had a whole, basically a biblical sized text and you just call it like the Heterodon Heresy or something like that.
Yeah. No. I'm going to go classic. And we'll see where I ultimately land with John. So that's where we're at.
Yeah. But you mentioned this a couple of times on your podcast, Kaluvir Glueboy Radio, which, by the way, if you guys aren't listening, you should definitely go over and listen. You guys do a great job over there.
Thank you. We try.
We all try. But I was wanting to ask you about your newest adventure, your new freshwater conservation center at West Liberty.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you want to take us how that first kind of started getting, how that kind of got off the runway and what your goal is for it?
So at the uni, I guess that's not entirely, I formalized the herpetology work in 2024, but I was dabbling with herpetology since 2015, I guess. Since 2006, when I started at West Lib, I've been doing crayfish research, and I've heard Dr. Warren Booth say this before, and I kind of like it, so I'll roll with it. He always talks about, like, he's a geneticist, and he studies urban pest ecology, and with that, he says, you know, that I'm an entomologist that studies genetics, or a geneticist that studies entomology, but the herpetology he does, and he does, like, extremely badass work. He refers that as his hobby research, and so the herpetology was my hobby research. So that's actually, ironically, has nothing to do with the center, though we'll see when we get done with this very long-winded intro. Herpetology is being done in there as well. But I am a crayfish biologist. So there are not that many crayfish biologists on the planet. We are having our biannual meeting. We have it every 2 years. It's called the International Association of Asticologists, because Asticus is the Latin word for crayfish. And that meeting has like 120 people at it. So that should tell you crayfish biologists are endangered themselves. So
what steps are the IUCN taking to preserve asticologists?
Oh, they've not really taken any.
Put you on the red list yet?
They've given us some work to do. I will say that we have our own subgroup of IUCN people working. But anyway, back to the
started a captive breeding project yet, or?
No, not for us. But anywho, so I did my PhD at Indiana State, and I was my dissertation was The Crayfishes of West Virginia. So a guy wrote a book in 1995, Ray Jezernik. He taught at Ohio State Newark, and basically his whole career was working on crayfish. He mentored my mentor, who's Roger Toma, a guy based out of Cleveland who was working out of Ohio State for a little while there. When they did that work, that was before we could go and catch an animal, take a tissue sample, run DNA, and look at their taxonomy more objectively than just looking at shapes and colors and things like that. So when it came time for me to get my doc, I was like, I want to do the crayfish of West Virginia. So I worked with West Virginia's DNR, and I got I thought at the time it was a rather large grant. I now know that they got away with murder with the amount of work I did for the amount of money that I had. But I don't care. I'm still forever in their debt. So I went out, and for my dissertation, I took a lot of West Liberty students where I teach, and they would work for the summer with me, and then we would go and collect crayfish, and we literally went from one end of West Virginia to the other. And if you flatten West Virginia out, if you can get rid of the mountains, it's bigger than Texas. So it's quite an endeavor to say you're going to go sample every river, every stream, and figure out the freaking distribution of these crayfish. And when I was doing that, I kept running into this big problem, which was I would catch an animal and, using modern methods, look at it and be like, that is not what the book says it is. And so that then kind of pushed me into this realm of describing new species, which I did not want to do. I did not set out to be a taxonomist. I'm a trained ecologist. That's what I do. I'm a conservation biologist. Taxonomy is its own world of insanity, as we all know. But I was pulled into it because the simple task I was given was to simply generate a list of crayfish that live in West Virginia. And I am a completionist. And I am this year, and I started that in 2006. So 20 years later, two decades later, I think I'm actually going to get, I would say, 95% of the diversity described, because I have to write a book for the state of West Virginia now. So this is a very long-winded intro to where the building came from. So in that process, in 2009, my students and I were down in the southern part of the state, and we stumbled onto this crayfish that was thought to be extinct in West Virginia. It was known at the time from Kentucky and Virginia, but the West Virginia populations were thought to be gone. And so when we found it, that was pretty awesome. We found one population in the Guyandot River. And then we found another population in what's called the Tug Fork River. And those two rivers, when they both dump into the Ohio River, but they dump in very, where the confluences are, is they're very far apart. So one is Huntington, if you know, just north of Huntington. That's the Guyandot River. And then the other one is, there's this magic area where Kentucky, West Virginia, and Ohio all meet. It's in West Virginia, it's called Canova. And in that general area, that's where the Big Sandy River dumps, but the Tug Fork dumps into the Big Sandy, which dumps into the Ohio. So genetically, there was evidence just looking at a map that these things might not be the same. And so I rather infamously took some legs, sent them off to my fellow crayfish nerd at Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh, Jim Fetzner. And then my mentor, Roger, was working in Kentucky and Virginia. And to make a very long story short, we found genetic evidence that the two things were different. So the Tug Fork population was different. The Guyandot population was different. So we described the Tug Fork as a new species. But when we did that, we were actually in the process of getting the two populations, when they were under the same name, federally listed, because these things have been thwacked by land use. Mining gets blamed a lot. Mining was a contributor, but land use, like timbering, development, industrial development, like lots of things contributed to these things becoming endangered. So ultimately, during the listing process, the two species were split from each other and described. And it was a valid split. I know herp people get really pissy when we start talking about splitting, but we had genes, we had geography, we had morphology in the end, we had color patterns, we had plenty of things to split them. And so when they got split, what ended up happening is we now have one species, Guyandot River crayfish, which is federally listed as endangered. And then we have another species, the Big Sandy crayfish, which is federally listed as threatened. And so what many people don't realize is the goal of the endangered species list is to get animals off of it. So you can't do that unless you have financial resources. And the only way you get financial resources, whether we want to talk about it or not, oftentimes is through getting things protected and then getting, you know, federal dollars in the mix. And so what was really interesting is when the animals got listed, I immediately started getting asked by industry, how do we get these things off this list? And I formed a very good relationship with industry. I tried to make them understand I'm not the enemy here. You know, we all did some actions that led to this animal's populations declining, but I am a firm believer in optimism, and I think we can get them off the list. So after talking to a lot of different people and agencies, industry, and academia, like all the different pots, buckets of people in conservation, I was sitting at the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection in Charleston, West Virginia. I was at a table, and I was with the mining division people who have to oversee mining, and they asked me, like, so what are the two ways that we can help get the animal off the list? I'd answered this question a million times, And I said, we got to restore the streams and we got to propagate the crayfish to then put back into the streams. And the DP was like, well, we can restore streams, but we don't know how to propagate a crawdad. And I was like, well, I can propagate a crawdad. And I noticed we have a phrase in West Virginia that I like a lot. It's not just a West Virginia phrase, but it's definitely used a lot here. And it is, people can have a shit-eating grin. And I saw a lot of the important people at the table kind of eyeballing each other, and they got this, they just, there was something happening, and I didn't know what it was. And so we went to lunch. I came back from lunch. We were going to have more conversations about getting people trained to work with the animals and everything. And they basically said to me, before they started the meeting back up again, hey, Zach, we got this proposal. It's for abandoned mine land use. If you write a proposal for a building on your campus, we can maybe fund it, and then you would be able to propagate these animals. And I was kind of flabbergasted. And so I said, sure, I'll write a proposal. I mean, as a professor, I have to get money to do all these fun things I do in the summertime. And so writing a grant is just like, that's what you do on Tuesday. I don't know. That's just what we do. So I wrote a proposal. I submitted the proposal and we got funded, and it's the largest chunk of change I've gotten personally. But the problem was, I submitted the proposal in 2019, and we all know what happened in March of 2020, which is a little thing called COVID. And so the budget was for building a building before COVID, and then we were building the building after COVID. So it took a very long time. Normally, a grant awarded in 2019, we would have a building in 2022, 2023. But it took a lot of people at my university thinking outside the box. I thought outside the box. We had a lot of grace from the West Virginia DEP. But ultimately, we were able to construct the building by taking over an old restaurant that was gifted to my school. And so we had a building already, which was awesome. And then we were able to build next to that building two propagation labs. And so when we built the building, what was funny is Department of Environment, West Virginia DEP, they said, we want crayfish propagated, but we don't want it just to be crayfish, which I thought was pretty awesome for them. And they said, we want aquatic species. And so right around 2023, I think, is when this happened. The years are all blurring together. It might have been 22. I started thinking, like, what the hell is the other animal we are going to raise at this building? And sorry, listeners, this doesn't have anything to do with herpetology for like the first, I don't know how many minutes, but we're getting there. And so in my world of aquatic conservation in Appalachia, there's three groups of animals that get a lot of propagation attention. Crayfish are not one of them, by the way. So this is very novel what we're doing. And I'll talk about my partner in that here in a minute. Freshwater mussels get propagated a lot. The only problem with freshwater mussels is I am not a malacology person. I can learn about a lot of animals, and I have learned how to field ID a lot of animals. And I'm the first one to admit freshwater mussels are the one group that just takes me out at the knees. And I think it's because they're, and this is going to probably piss off a malacologist or two, but the whole living rock thing, I can't get into that. I love their life history. Their biology is fascinating. But I just can't get past like the adult is it's just like a rock. I don't know. So yeah, I knew we were not doing mussels.
Yeah, to me, the coolest part about mussels is that I occasionally find a fossil of a bivalve in my driveway's gravel. So,
yeah, no.
that's about the extent of my interest in them. So,
yeah, no. So there was that. But then the other thing about freshwater mussels is like propagating freshwater mussels, it's an art as much as it is a science. They all have their own unique host fish, or in some instances, they put their larvae into mud puppies and, you know, crazy things. So you have to be able to get the host fish. Then you have to get the mussels ready to spawn. Then you have to put them together. And I was just like, I just don't want to deal with that. And then I'm dealing with like 19 and 20 year olds who are going to be in this space, which is like, this is too complicated. The next group of organisms are non-game fish. So things like, if you know what these are, darters.
Yeah.
suckers, you know, things like that. And I could do that. I never talk about it, but I had a lot of fish tanks growing up, and native fish tanks was actually something I got into pretty hard.
Yeah, darts are underrated.
Mm-hmm, massively. But I just didn't want to. I also knew, like, there's a lot of technical aquaculture technique, and I didn't want to be beholden to that per se. And so then I just sat back one day and was like, turtles. Why don't we raise turtles? You're a herpetoculture guy. I like turtles. I was like, let's do turtles. So I started talking, and at the university, we have our zoo science major, and I was able to get into what's called the North American SAFE program with AZA. So that's Saving Animals from Extinction. And that's when I was thrust head first into the turtle crisis. And it is a crisis. I would say if herpetoculture has a black eye, a deep black eye, it would be what some of our people, not all of our people, some of our people have done with, you know, supporting capturing turtles, shipping them to Asia. You know, we talk a lot about regs, and we get really upset when we talk about regs and herpetoculture. But after seeing what I've seen, I kind of understand where some of that is coming from. And so what we ultimately end up doing is we were able to work our way in, and we have had several. We mostly work with spotted turtles, and the spotted turtles are they've all of our animals, unfortunately, were intercepted at airports. So they were on their way to somewhere other than the United States. And the volume of turtles is just disgusting that are being intercepted. It's not like five. It's like 100 spotted turtles. And they're in horrible shape. And so we've got to get them back to where they need to be. Don't even get me started with box turtles. That's the other species we're working with. They're not aquatic, but they are Appalachian. Hundreds of spot, like 200-300 Eastern box turtles will get intercepted at the airport. It's not, you know, 50. And then we don't know what to do with them. So that's what we're doing with the other part of the building. We're propagating these endangered crayfish, and then we're working on box turtle recovery once they're intercepted at the airport. Like, what the hell do we do with these things? And then we're also doing a lot of spotted turtle work where we're going to be captive breeding them. And I'm not going to say where, but the offspring will be used to repopulate natural occurring populations. So that's what we're doing with the building, with the propagation side of the building. And then I need to say this very quickly. So while we were building the building, there's this awesome aquaculture guy named Drew Phipps at White Sulphur Springs National Fish Hatchery in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, who he got hired on there early on in the process of us building, and said, I want to work with you. I want to propagate these crayfish. And so Drew did all the hard work because he figured out how to do the propagation piece or the head starting piece. And so we basically build a building, and now Drew's handing us on a silver platter what we got to do with these crayfish. So we're one permit away from being able to work on the crayfish. But yeah, no, the building opened up on October 23rd of 2025. So there you go.
Yeah, congratulations on finally getting that done then.
Oh, thank you.
I was going to say it's been
a slog.
So. I was going to say, dang, all that freshwater space at all that indoor freshwater facilities and a single crocodilian. What a waste.
I got you. Those extinct ones that were in Appalachia, if they were still around, that could do it. But according one of the rules of the grant, I can't talk tonight, is that
had to be native species or?
Oh, yeah. You have to follow the mission of the proposal for a certain time. I think it's 6 years. We have to be limited to Appalachian stuff. But I promise you, Nate, there will be some crocodilian being head started in there if I ever get the chance to do it, because that is extremely high on my wish list of things I want to do before I retire. So,
yeah. So, and you also have, I actually did take a tour of your herp facilities once, And I will say it's pretty impressive, but you want to go for this might be a bit of a tall order to go, but brief, what are some like the major highlight species in your collection, both personally and at school? I mean, obviously falsies to start off, and Florida Kings, but
well, we'll do the collection I have here at the house is it's really funny because it's getting more and more basic as the years go on. I have my own group of false water cobras, which shocker, anybody that knows me knows that that's that. And then here at the house, I have three groups of glubroids that I keep. I have a bunch of hogs. I have southern hogs, western hogs, or plains hogs, western hogs, whatever you want to call them, and Mexican hogs here. And I just recently moved a bunch of king snakes out to get room for Pitchophis. I've always wanted to keep pines and bulls and gophers, but here at the house, I was having massive problems with ventilation and airflow, and I figured that all out in 2024. And so in 2025, I bought some, I don't like calling them guinea pigs, but that is essentially what they were. I bought some adult Kankakee bull snakes, and I kept them the way I thought I needed to keep them. And I prayed a lot, and they made it, and they bred, and they rebounded, and all's well. And so now I have a bunch of San Diego gophers that are morphs. I'm trying to get into the morph thing. I've never really been into that, but that's a thing.
So that's why
my Kankakee bulls.
So that's why you put so much money on that albino bull, a pine, at the first auction.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, it actually wasn't that much money. That's the thing that was like shocking to me. But anywho, he's here actually. I think his name was Leopold when we bought him. I don't know. It's just an albino bull. He bred last year. So there are het albino Kankakee bull snakes floating around in the ether because of him. And then I have some Pitchophis catnefer pumilis catalina, I think is the island. I got them from Eric Westmoreland. They're an island endemic. That's a perfect example of island dwarfism, which is fantastic. They look more like freaking garter snakes than they do gopher snakes, which is pretty cool. So those are here now. And then the kings, I basically whittled my rather large collection down to just Floridiana localities, and if you believe in it, Means Eye localities. So that's what I have for king snakes, because that's what I like. And then I've gotten a couple, I don't ever get to talk about this on CCR, some Boyds. So I have yellow anacondas again.
Woo!
Boa Sigma are here, and I have a couple blood pythons, so because I like short tails. And that's it for here. And then when you go to school, everything changes.
So you like the high metabolism, high mobility falsies, and you're like, you know what? I want the complete opposite of that. Let me get it in short tails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let me get this closest thing to a log with a lung.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think short tails get enough love. I mean, for me, they're perfect. You got to be able to read them. I agree with the short tail people. They're misunderstood. I mean, they will definitely be defensive. They're not aggressive. If you push them, they'll push back. But if you treat them with respect and kind of figure out what you got to do to not piss them off or irritate them, they're fine. So now at the school, that's just how much time do we have? Because this will take a long time. But to kind of give the highlight reel, we have a lot of turtles, a lot of a fair amount of lizards, and then a fair amount of snakes. So all the snakes that are here are essentially at the school too. We have kind of highlight reels. I inherited a collection of Florida King snakes from Jen Archer. So we have over 100. We have pretty much every morph that exists for Floridana, with the exception of maybe a handful. And that's one of our research colonies. So we have those, a bunch of false water cobras. We have a research colony of hognose snakes, a research colony of Pitchophis. And then several monitors. We have our big 7-foot flagship animal of our collection, Norbert. He's a water monitor that's in a massive enclosure that cost more than my first car to build. He's spoiled there. Yeah, no, he's about 7.5 feet, and I think he weighs about 45 pounds. So, well, on our other large animal, here's your crocodilian. We have a Paleosuchus trigonatus, one of the smooth-fronted caimans, which is one of my favorite animals that we have.
Is he kind of punchy?
He's punchy, but he's interesting. He is only punchy when you get near him. You can be in his enclosure. You can be walking around. It's just if you get like 18 inches, he does a lot of mock strikes and open hissing and stuff like that. He was not handled the way I wanted him to be handled when we were raising him, so he does not like to be touched.
So he just kind of like stays in, a corner of the pool and just kind of stares daggers at you if you're on the other side?
Yes. One of my 2026 goals is to be able to get him to shift into a traveling bin, because I don't like what we have to do to get him into the bin right now. So
they had to do the whole roping and jumping stuff.
Not even really roping and jumping. It's just, I mean, I've caught more alligators than I want to admit in the South. And so I just kind of walk up and do the whole grab by the neck and move, but I don't like doing that because just all the vibes are bad. And so if I can just get him to go into the damn shift box, it's better for all of us. So that's what we're going to try to do. All right. So we've got those two. We have Varanus gillinii, pygmy mulga monitor, sounds I think right. is a common name. And then olive python. We have a lot of pythons at school. We have a pair of olives. We have a pair of water pythons. That's our liasis. We have a bunch of ball pythons that people just kind of gave us to be expected.
I was going to say, if you're taking things from the public, I'm batching up a bunch of balls, a bunch of beardies, and a bunch of leopard geckos.
Yes. Well, we only have one leopard and one beardie currently. We also have... on the lizard front, gargoyle geckos, crested geckos. We have a rather large Legionis colony, which we're kind of proud of. I forgot to say, we have Womas, Aspidites, Ramsai. That's one of my favorite snakes. In fact, we're trying to breed those this year. This is all over the place now. Drymarkin. So we have yellowtail Kribos. I have a Texas... I like the word Kribo better than indigo for them. Eastern indigos and yellowtails. Blacktails, Texas, yellowtail,
and Eastern indigos.
There the we Cooperi, go. So yeah. Those are our Drymarkin. So it's pretty decent collection. And then in the Appalachian Aquatic Conservation Center, I work a lot with the West Virginia DNR. And so we've worked out a relationship with DNR. Where when they confiscate animals or whenever they have animals surrendered to them, you know, they are the first ones to admit we don't have the training to take care of these. And so we get a lot of those. And so that enables me to have a permit to display native species, because you're not allowed to have native species in West Virginia. And so we have the Snakes of West Virginia display, which has a lot of animals that are native, like corn snakes and king snakes and garters and things like that. But the thing I'm most proud of in that display is that we have a handful of Eastern hognose snakes that we raised and were able to convert to a like rodent / reptilink diet. And so we do have platyrhinos at the center. So that's pretty cool.
You're able to make the platyrhinos rodent jump. That's impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a guy named Matt Dove who, anybody that wants to give that a go, make sure you can legally do it, because many people don't realize you can't. Many of the states where platies live, you can't keep native species, so you don't want to like get yourself into a bad situation. But Matt is the master. He's got the magic touch for doing that. So I take no credit. It's all him.
All right. I was fortunate enough to go to the first ever Kluberfest. Unfortunately, I had to cancel my plans to go to the second one. Hopefully, I'll be able to go to the third one.
Cool.
That's going to be in Matt's neck of the woods.
No, it's in Clint's neck of the woods.
Clint's, right.
Evansville, Indiana.
So even further away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, I was so hopeful when you said Cincinnati at first. Then
we were pushing very hard for Cincinnati. The thing is, Indiana's regs are the best for colubrids and colubroids because of the whole native species thing. If we have it in Ohio, like black rat snakes and morphs can't be sold there. So
yeah,
we ended up listening to Mickey, but Clint and I, what's really funny is that Clint is from Evansville. A lot of people know that. And Clint initially was not pushing Evansville. I think he was the last to push Evansville. I surrendered and thought, yeah, Evansville could work before Clint did. So that needs, I'm going to keep saying that as many times as I can, because I've already heard a couple people be like, oh, they're just doing this because Clint's in Evansville. And like, that is not the reason why. So anyway.
So he's like that one kid who never let his, never wants his friends over at his house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something like that.
Okay. And so Evansville, I'm guessing it's going to be in September.
Oh, it's the last weekend of September. So if we're talking about it this year, Kluberbird Fest 2026 is the last weekend in September, and it's in Evansville, Indiana. And, you know, anytime you're doing something like Kluberbird Fest, it's going to take a while before it gets dialed in. And one of the things that we are trying to do, which is like climbing Mount Improbable, it is impossible to make everybody happy. We are trying to cut the expense down so much that all you have to do is pay for your ticket, your food, and your hotel room. And we don't want a bougie, expensive hotel room. And that is one of the main
reasons parking.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about parking here in a minute. I want those to be your expenses, and you can't, I'm sorry, you can't make that happen in a large city. It's just not going to happen. So these smaller cities like Evansville or Fort Wayne, or, you know, I was talking about Pittsburgh because that's close to me. You go downtown Pittsburgh, no, but there's all these cities that are around Pittsburgh. So like, yeah, that's where we were looking. Because the first Kluberbird Fest, the one you went to, it was in downtown Indy in this big, bad, beautiful convention center.
But it's like, you know, right next to the Colt Stadium and everything.
Yeah, but to park, it was costing people $40 a day. And so, you know, in Evansville, we finally got it to where parking's free. All these accessory, all these things that kind of nickel and dime people, they're all eliminated. And that's what you get when you end up having it in a place like Evansville. So now we are working on getting the block of hotel rooms, which we are almost certain we are going to get. But I think that all that overhead expense of just existing in Evansville for the weekend is going to be dramatically less than even how much it costs to go to like Daytona, because Daytona isn't cheap. Tinley isn't cheap. So so we're trying to make it so that people can afford it. And that's one of the main reasons why cities like Evansville were on our, were considered. So there you go.
Yeah. I was going to say, parking in Indy is expensive, but you're talking about Tinley, just going through all the toll roads in yeah, Chicagoland. That mm-hmm, adds up to like three whole days of parking in Indy, just driving around for a couple of hours.
Oh, hell yeah. And the nice thing about it this year is the first 2 years we did it, Kluberbird Fest 1, Kluberbird Fest 2, you had the hotel was here, and it was at a 10 to 15 to 20 minute drive to the venue. And one of the things we realized when we had it in Fort Wayne, even though we were going to keep it in Fort Wayne before we were asked to go someplace else, is that it would be great if we could actually get a freaking hotel that had a space that we could have the show in, and then we could have the lectures in. And so we do kind of look at the getting booted out of Fort Wayne as a blessing in disguise, because now with this venue, you get to the hotel and you can be done for the weekend on Friday, because the rooms are going to be where the show is. The rooms are going to be where the talks are. There are restaurants all within walking distance of the hotel. Evansville has an airport, so people that are from far away don't, like, many people don't realize that. That's one of the things we're pushing, is that you can fly into Evansville and Uber to the hotel and not have to get a car. So I'm excited to see what happens with Evansville. I will fully admit, everybody on the CCR side of the fence, Max, Clint, and I, we were kind of butt-puckered at first when we were announcing it in Evansville, because we were like, oh, God, here we go. But Mickey was the one. Yeah. Mickey was the guy that was like, calm down, people. It's going to be fine. And while I'm certain there are people that are not thrilled with it being at Evansville, I've heard way more, hey, cool. Yeah. Then we have thought. So that's kind of let us take a breath here. And to be honest, it doesn't really matter. I know it matters where it is, because that's going to dictate. There is an expense getting to Colubrid Fest, but we put it in the Midwest. It's still 10 to 8 hours away from most major population centers, obviously excluding places like California, and the Mountain West. But it's going to be good. It's going to be great. And I can't wait for it to happen.
Yeah. Like I said, hopefully I'll be able to make it there as well. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. You know, university life's always hectic. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I did want to talk. I know I didn't want to give you too much of an aneurysm during your little off period from school, but talk a little bit about North American snake taxonomy.
Sure.
I was curious about African snake taxonomy, but don't want the house snake people trying to tear down the place with pitchforks and torches. Mm-hmm. So. North American taxonomy. So
sure.
I listened to your episode a while back with the rat snakes. So there's now three species, right? Of what was a black or gray rat snake is now a Opsoleta aligonensis and quadrivitatis. Do I have that right?
Or sploid. It's Opsoletus. It used to be Opsoleta. Now it's Opsoletus, T-U-S. That is the westernmost form. There's Alleghaniensis, and then there's Spiloides. And I did not do a refresher between getting on tonight, but I'm fairly positive. If you listen, we did the one episode you just talked about on CCR where we explained the whole history. I've had a lot of people tell me that's one of their favorite episodes. So if you are a rat snake person hearing this, go give that a listen. It's 2 hours of fun. But when Burbrink did the initial naming, he kind of fumbled some of the rules of zoological nomenclature. So to add insult to injury, for a long time, what is known as Spiloides was from the Appalachians west to the Mississippi River. That is now, if I'm not mistaken, I believe that's now Alleghaniensis, because of the way that the type localities and everything fell. Now Spiloides is the thing that's along the East Coast.
Okay.
I think.
That'll probably change in another year or two anyway. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what I was more curious on is, I remember when we first had you on, you were talking about how colubrids have been kind of split off. Colubrids as a group has been split up into, nature scenes, have been split up into their own, elevated into their own group. And your particular group, why am I blanking on the
Dipsadids?
The Dipsadids got elevated up to their own promoted to their own high ranking. And you gave some examples of true colubrids here in North America. I was kind of curious. I'm guessing colubrid is a true colubrid, but like the racers and the coach whips and stuff like that, those are true colubrids, right?
Yes. They would be in the family Colubridae. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, Masticophis and colubrid, absolutely Colubridae.
All right. So the extent of true colubrids in North America is Lampropeltis, Pantherophis, Masticophis, colubrid. Why am I blanking on the one? Oh, Pituophis. Yeah. And is that about it?
Well, there's more than that. So when you get into,
well, like some like the more Central America stuff that gets into like the Southwest.
No, there's still more genera in North America. So within the family Colubridae, there are within any. Okay, how do I explain this? So if a family has received what we call a taxonomic revisionary work, so a herpetologist in this case has decided to dabble and try to add order to the disorder within a family, oftentimes what ends up happening is it's easy to put genera in a family. That can be done relatively straightforwardly. But where things get difficult is that sometimes some genera are more related to other genera, and some genera are disparate, which means that they're not closely related. And when that ends up happening, what there is a taxonomic level between a genus and a family, and that's what we call a tribe. And tribes
are, like the Labropeltini?
Yes. And so with the tribe, to using modern methods, a lot of people would just refer to a tribe as a clade within the family Colubridae. But we have to have these Linnaean terms, so we use the word tribe. And so there is a tribe, which you got the cat out of the bag on that one, called the Labropeltini. Oh, no, it's fine. No problem. And within the within that tribe, all the snakes that we keep are basically, most of them anyway, are in that tribe. And so the Labropeltini includes everything, or well, I shouldn't say everything, almost everything that is a true colubrid, except for the racers, the whip snakes, the indigos and crebos, and a couple of the more diminutive true colubrids. But within that tribe Labropeltini, you have Lampropeltis, which are the kings of the milks, Pantherophis, which is the rat snakes, Bodrotophis.
Oh, Bodrotophis, of course, yeah.
The Transpacos, Pitchophis, the pines, bulls, and gophers, Arizona, which is the glossy snake, and then Semophora, which is the scarlet snake. And then, oh my God, come back to me. Pseudolaphis in there too, which is the Middle American cat-eyed snake. So those are all your Labropeltinids. And so though that's one tribe, and then you've got the tribe that includes the whips, Mastacophis, Coluber, and I cannot remember if Drymarchin's in there or not. But anyway, so it's basically,
now that you mention it, indigo does, Crebo does kind of look like someone gave a bunch of TRT to a whip snake.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, totally. Yeah, no. They're, and they all have a similar biology, similar ecology, similar morphology. They fill similar niche space. So
both are very Ophisophagus.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. So
I never really thought of it that way. I always thought they're more Labropeltini, but now you mention it, it doesn't make a lot more sense that they would be closer to the whips and coaches.
Yep. I'm questioning everything.
It's like, I don't want to come on another person's show and look like an idiot.
Peltini. I'm just going to look it up real quick and make sure we're good. So, yes. Oh, Rhinocheleus. I forgot Rhinocheleus. That's the, and Centocolus. Those were the two that I forgot. Centocolus is the green rat snake. Very cool snake. And there's one other one there. And then Rhinocheleus is a long-nosed snake, which is a wonderful snake.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing that's another Southwest species?
Yes. And what you see within Labropeltini, which is really cool, is you see with the diet, you either feed heavily on
rodents,
vertebrates, or eggs. Those are the two, or you do both. So you have things like Semophora and Rhinocheleus that are eating squamate eggs primarily, and then lizards occasionally. But then within the verts, they're separating out the vertebrate taxa so that usually you'll have like a pine or a gopher. Where the pine and gophers live, you don't get many Pantherophis, but you can have Lampropeltis because pines and gophers feed heavily on endothermic prey, whereas the
Labropels are very,
So, yeah.
Yeah. So you're saying there's an open ecological space on the Canary Islands for a Pituophis then?
There you go. Mm-hmm.
No, don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that.
Okay. Now, I did mention I had a question about African snake taxonomy. It wasn't actually taxonomy related. So the house snake people could put their pitchforks down.
Yeah.
A while back, me and Brian did a little episode where we did a build our dream reptile park, so to speak. And mm-hmm. we basically had, like I said, like what's top five indoor exhibits you would have. And I did large colubrids of the world. And then I got to Africa and I got stumped and I couldn't think of a large colubrid from Africa. I was like, I still can't think of one. Do you know of any?
So when you say colubrid, are you meaning like colubrid
and colubroid? Colubrids and colubroids. So like I had falsies in there.
There's several. Yeah. So colubrid, you could do thraisops, which is, cannot remember their common name to save my life. They're a very large, mostly black, rear fanged species that I'm fairly certain is a colubrid. Bone slangs are true colubrids, so you could have
I'm good. No boom slangs in my park. I don't want my eyeballs to melt.
Yeah, there you go. That's fair. And then I'm trying to think what the hell else? Those are all samophidae. If you hop over to the samophids, which is the thing that includes like the house snakes and pretty much most of the large colubroid, the colubroid is not even the right word. They're more like an elapid than they are a freaking colubrid. That those animals, there's lots. There's mole snakes, which are basically Africa's version of a pine snake, which is this big burly critter that'll hiss and do all kinds of fun stuff. You have those. You also would have at your disposal the all the different sand snakes, which those are all very cool, very, very cool animals.
I kind of had that as like a European section, but
yeah. And then Grayidae, the African garter snakes, which aren't garters, but they're these big, heavy bodied animals that live. There's quite a few that live in the Congo and the rainforest there that are not very well understood. I think Mike Clarkson has some, and I think that they have them at Reptilandia with Ari, but those would be what I would keep.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify, why is that large colubrid? I meant something that got like north of the 2 meter mark.
So. Yeah. No, all of those get above the two meter mark.
Really? I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, whenever I think of Africa snakes, it's like the pythons, the lapids, the pit vipers, and like the house snakes. And that's, I think maybe it's just the pop herpetology image of African mm-hmm. snakes, but
no, there's quite a few long, like 2 meter plus colubrids and colubroids there. Now, like a bone slang can get to be that big, but it's going to be the diameter of a quarter.
So, yeah.
Lot of arboreal critters.
Is it a large colubrid or is it a long colubrid?
Mm-hmm. There you go. Of those, the grayids that I mentioned, the grayidae, that family, they are heavy-bodied, and that mole snake is very heavy-bodied. So
okay, so that's,
and then you could cross into Madagascar and get my favorite African genera, which is Leoheterodon.
Yeah, the African hognose.
Malagasy giant hognose snake is a big snake. What if you get a large adult male? That's definitely 2 meters plus.
Yeah. Okay. Definitely. If I ever do, that ever does happen, I'll have to consider that. let's see here. What's something else? So going back to North American taxonomy, your favorite group, the Dipsatids, they seem to be more like a South American, more diverse in South America. But I remember reading your book that it might have originated in Asia.
There's a lot of evidence that points towards them originating in Asia, coming across Beringia, which I still to this day am trying to figure out how the hell they did that. That's the land bridge between Russia and Alaska. And then
to be fair, somehow alligators did that as well, going the other direction. So
yeah, coming down, waiting for the American interchange to happen, which is where Central America, you know, you get the two plates coming up, and then North and South America get connected. And then they get down into South America, explode. And then the idea is either did ours result from South America and Central American snakes kind of coming back up into North America, or did that initial Asiatic radiation have a spur that went off into North America while the rest of them went down into Central and South America? And what's really fun is that there's three subfamilies underneath the family Dipsatidae. There's Carpophianae, which is what we have in North America. There's Dipsatidae, which is what's in Central America, and then Xenodontinae, which is what is in South America. Jesus. But like the hogs, Heterodon, they actually are not in any of those formal subfamilies because people cannot figure out where the hell they go. Like when you do the molecular work, they always kind of end up in different parts of the tree. Now, I would not be the least bit surprised if in the next 5 to 10 years, that's all resolved, because the way that we used to do the genetics is compared to what we're doing in 2026 now. It's like trying to build a house with matches is what we were doing when we figured all this stuff out, versus building it with modern 2x4s and technology. Like, we can do the whole genome now and compare genome to genome, which that will add the resolution that we need to figure out where the hell these snakes came from.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a lot better than trying to compare mitochondrial DNA or some other like snippet or something like that.
Yep.
So with those, that South American radiation, do they have an estimate of when they got to South America? Was it like when the continents actually formally joined? Because I know there was a bit of interchange between the Americas before the isthmus actually formed. So
yeah, just some of them kind of rafted out into the Caribbean basin, the Dipsatids, and those were difficult for people to place as to which of these subfamilies they belong to. They ultimately were put in the Xenodontines, which is the major radiation from South America. What is very interesting to me is that major radiation of South American snakes. And just so people know, if you recognize the family Dipsatidae, and there's still people that don't, I imagine as time goes on, they will slowly be extirpated, just like the animals we study. And the more modern approach is going to be adopted, because if you understand the modern way of doing this, it's very hard to look at the data and not recognize Colubridae as a junk drawer taxa that needs to be split. So with that being said, the South American Dipsatids are actually young. So they probably didn't get there until 20 to 15 million years ago.
That sounds about right.
And they've subsequently just exploded, filling up all those niches. And what's really cool is a lot of people think that if you know anything about the Cenozoic era, which is the age of mammals, that's like the colloquialism.
So unless it's South America, then it's a different matter.
Yeah. The asteroid hits at the end of the Cretaceous period. It sucks for a little while, but then everything kind of goes back to the way it was in the Cretaceous, which was warm, humid, and wet. And that's what we call the Paleocene and the Eocene period. And then at the end of the Eocene, that's when we start getting into things like the Miocene, Oligocene, you know, all those different scenes. That's when we start to get this period of cooling, and the world gets cooler and drier.
Grasslands, yeah.
Yes, and that period of time is when a lot of these South American colubroids just proliferate and explode. And so they're not old. That's the point. So you go to a place like Southeast Asia, and those snakes are old. Like, lots of those genera and families, they've been around for 30 million years. Whereas South American snakes, not so much. And the other thing I want to say, just to throw it out there, because they don't get the love that they deserve. Their Dipsadidae is the most diverse family of snakes. Like, there are more Dipsadids than any other group of snakes on the planet. So they're the Americas. There are some in Asia. Don't get me wrong. There's not many, but there's some. But like, I feel like we need to spread the Dipsadid love more than we do. If I hear one more person, when you ask like, if you had a dream reptile trip, where would you go? And like the default answer is always Australia. And I'm like, no, I want to go to Australia. I ironically want to go to Australia just as much to see the crayfish that live in Australia as I do the reptiles and amphibians. But South America, man.
My God, mate, even the crayfish down here have a pouch.
Yeah, there you go. Even if you want diversity and you want to see lots of different creatures, South America, man, that's just where it's at. So that's my 2 cents on that.
Yeah, I need to go back. So
I haven't been there yet. Somehow I wrote a damn book on these things and I haven't gone. So I've been to Central America several times. I just have not made it to South America. So
yeah, well, maybe one day we could drag you down to Colombia with us.
Oh, I'll go. Just call me.
I was going to say, if I ever manage to see a falsie before you, I'll definitely text you a picture of it just rubbing your face.
There you go.
But I do have a lot of questions to ask you. However, those are more questions I had to ask about my personal career goals and advancements after we're done recording. So I don't want to give everyone my life, the whole internet, my life goals. So
there you go.
That's a recipe for disaster. But
I don't hear you.
Yeah, but Brian and me started doing this little thing of what country or location would be your dream herp trip destination?
This is super easy.
I've just answered it. So,
yeah, it's northeastern Australia or southwestern Paraguay. That's where all the snakes that I love, like my bucket list snakes, all live there. So, and I absolutely want to go to the Amazon. Don't get me wrong. But for me, that part of South America it's where I want to go very, very badly. So, and even Bolivia, there's a couple places in Bolivia where there's ecotourism where you can basically go and the guy picks you up at the airport and you go around these ag fields. It's about the least attractive part of South America you go to, but the animals come in because it's a desert scrub.
And that's where all the water is.
And that's where the water is. Exactly. And so of course the falsies are in the irrigation canals. And so, yeah, but like my top five snakes to see in the wild, like I would pass out if I saw a green anaconda, but I would be so much happier to see a yellow anaconda. Yellow Noteus lives right next to the false waters in that part of the world. False Musarana, Boruna. I have those here at the house, wrote a book chapter on them. They're apparently, according to a couple people that have been down there that I've talked to, they basically said, if you go down there and don't see Boruna, you know, that would shock them. Both props, the lance heads, they're very high on my venomous wish list. Yeah, there's Eurythrus down there. There's all kinds of stuff down there.
You gotta narrow down on Bothrops. That's like what, 50 species?
No, there's several that are down there. But I would say if I wasn't going there, I've actually started paying a lot of attention to Suriname. I really want to go to Suriname because you get all those Amazonian things. But Helicops, that's another one I really like. They're very common. But I want to see those. Corallus, all the tree boas. Green anacondas, like, so yeah, no, for me, that's it. We're done.
Okay. And I wanted to actually make sure that I had labeled these guys right for my Costa Rica trip I did back in 24. Sibon, the snail eaters, mm-hmm. the snail suckers, are those Dipsadids?
Yes. Those are Dipsadid A.
Dipsadid A, yeah.
Mm hmm.
So, yeah, those things were literally the most common thing I saw on the trip, snake-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I saw Nebulata so many times, it got kind of boring.
Did you see any of the cat-eyed snakes, Leptodyra?
We did see We did actually. I got two speeches left of Daira, one in Colombia and one in Costa Rica. So
yeah, left of Daira.
We got the in Colombia. We got the Ash Meets Cat Eye Snake. So,
yep, and then they're dips at it. Yeah. So,
and is it Trilegodon? Is that it? The Liar Snakes. Those are. Are those Colubras?
Oh, those are Dipsadids.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, got Central American one as well. Central American Liar in Costa Rica as well. So
very cool.
Probably a lot more, cool. But mm-hmm. Yeah. So, is there anything you would want to close out on?
No, just thank you for having me on.
And make sure you apply to university at West Liberty, right?
Oh, well, hell yeah. I mean, if you're listening to this and you're a college student, a high school student, and you want to do herpetology, just consider West Liberty. We are in Northern West Virginia. The price for tuition is reasonable if you're even for out of state folks. And we do all of our teaching with actual animals in hand. Like, I pinch myself when I teach herpetology every fall, because a lot of people will teach about different python genera. And when I do pythons, I have a liasis there. I have Aspidites there. I've got python there, like a ball python, a short tail python. So I'm teaching while I'm holding the damn thing. And then the students are coming. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. So,
I notice a major gap in that lineup.
What would that be?
Where's my Somalia at? You gotta know.
We have Somalia. Oh, I didn't even talk about Somalia. We have Bolin's pythons, man.
Oh, you lucky bastard.
Yeah, no. We have.
You rich son of a bitch.
Well, we actually had somebody donate their Bolin eye to us. They didn't want them getting out into the pet trade. And they were like, would you take these? I was like, are you freaking kidding me? Yeah, no, we have two adult males that are each over 6 foot. They're amazing.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, those are in the room, too. Yeah. So if you're into that kind of thing, consider us. And then I also have the graduate lab. The grad lab right now is full. It will not be full. And this time next year, I will probably be recruiting for the fall of 27. So,
all right.
So there you go.
All right.
Yep. But yes, please, West Liberty University, Zoo Science, and then give our podcast a listen to if you haven't, Colubrid and Colubrid Radio. If you like colubrids, there's two. We also support our good friend Joe with his podcast, but Colubrid Radio, give it a listen.
All right. Thanks for coming on.
No problem. Thank you.